Hi, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of On The Verge. On today's episode, I am joined by Bianca, who is a content creator analyzing some relationship and friendship trends that she notices in society. She's very funny and has some great insights for your 20s. I hope you really enjoy this episode. And remember, you can now listen to the episode on all platforms and also watch it on YouTube. Hope you enjoy.
This is On The Verge.
Hello, everyone. I'm very excited for today's episode. This is Bianca. She's a guest that I found scrolling on TikTok that I think has great insights on society in general. She has this page where she's technically analyzing social trends that she sees in friendships, relationships, just basically all around her. Bianca is from near Chicago or from Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago.
Studied English in university, then went on to work in the entertainment industry and now lives in New York. So I'm very fortunate to have her right across from me. Bianca, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to be here.
No, I love your content. And you know what you have that's so special? There's like one video that I'll see from you and I'll be like cracking up. And then the next one, I'm like thinking about my whole existence and my life. And you're like just so right on the dot about the things that you're saying that I'm like, this girl has just like such an eye to see what's happening in society. That's incredible.
Thank you. I mean, I have to tip my hat to my parents. They put me in therapy starting when I was 5. So it became like a weekly thing for me to be forced to just like analyze my life, analyze what was going on with the lives of the people around me. And it just became this muscle that I developed and I had to flex like every week for coming up on now like 21 years.
Yeah, not everyone has that.
No. It was just this, it was kind of like my, a different education of how to think.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So kind of viewing therapy as a tool that like allowed you to see the world maybe a bit differently than everyone else.
I mean, it's definitely a double-edged sword because when you're, you know, like 5 or 8 or 10 or whatever, it's, sometimes you just want to like be a kid and live your life and not be forced to like take a step back and introspect all the time. It definitely made me feel a lot more on edge about like making mistakes or anything like that. But at the same time, it's a really great tool for like learning how to think and how to think outside of yourself too, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just seeing the world around you and being like, why is this happening?
As well.
So you see, you just notice all these things because kind of it's how your brain works. When did you decide to start making these videos and why post them?
So when I was living in LA in the winter of 2021, I got COVID and I was like one of the last people in the world to get COVID. It was so uncool.
I call it vintage. I'm like because I got COVID super late as well.
Yeah.
I was telling my friends, this is so COVID. Vintage. Like, why do I have COVID now?
I know. It was very gauche. But I was basically like, you know, staying away from people for a week and I had nothing to do. And I just came up with this idea for, it would be like even too nerdy for me to explain it right now. But basically there's this philosophical concept called an Occam's razor, if you've ever heard of it. Yeah, I'm going to butcher it, but it basically is this theory that holds that like the simplest idea is the best. Philosophy nerds will come after me for like not fully explaining that, but it makes sense for the context in which I'm explaining it now. And I just came up with this weird little idea to do a skit based on that with like an actual physical razor. And I posted it and I was confident that like nobody was going to understand what I meant. It was going to fly over people's heads. And then all of a sudden it was like racking up the views and it got to like 45,000 views. And this was like my first ever post. And I was just amazed that there was an audience for this incredibly niche, like weird humor that I came up with. And it was very heartwarming to be like, wow, there's an audience for anything, really. And so I started posting more like comedic skit videos for like a month or two. And then I got tired of it because I was running out of ideas. And I think nothing would like hit I had a couple of videos go over 1 million that were really cool, but I was starting to lose steam. And then over the next couple of years, I would like post every 6 months or something, but I didn't really feel a strong purpose with it. And then recently, like, I just decided to get on there and start talking about the things that I would talk about with my friends or that I would analyze with my therapist or whatever. And the first one to hit it big was this assessment of dating apps and how they've gone downhill in recent times. And that one just completely took off. And it was really interesting to see, I wasn't necessarily reinventing the wheel with anything I was saying. And I think that would, I mean, if I were to sit here and tell you I was, or if anyone were to sit here and tell you that they were reinventing the wheel with their content, I think
they're lying.
Yeah. But I think what I realized is that, you know, there so many experiences are truly so much more universal than we realize. And if you can just like articulate your own perspective on them, like people find comfort and find solace in that. And it just really emboldened me to want to continue, you know, sharing my thoughts on things. Because really, like there are people online who are completely like certified, and they have been like, you know, 3 degrees, and they can speak from an area of authority and expertise. Yeah, 100%. And like, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who is currently on her 4th degree, who wanted to start a TikTok, and I was saying to her, like, you have to lean on your expertise because that's so powerful, because the vast majority of people, myself included, are just people whose credibility is like living life. And
but funnily enough, I think that's the strong suit though. Mm-hmm. Because at least for me, like me as a consumer, I'm like, sometimes I'm tired of like the expert. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want the normal person living through life. And I think what you have that's unique, it's like you're taking this very like, yeah, just like you're, it's what you're saying. You're like, I'm out here living life, but you're also so observant that you describe it in just like the perfect way. And that's why people are like, oh my God, yes. And it's true. You're not reinventing the wheel. Like you're not saying anything that's crazy, but mm-hmm. you're just describing it. And you're so right on the dot. I think that's why people like it. And you're not telling them like, oh, this is how life works, but more like, oh, this is what I observe. And people kind of see that for themselves, and they're like, yeah, I relate to this. It's exactly what I see as well.
Yeah. No, it's cool. And I think what's also interesting is then like, and I don't know why, and I don't post very controversial things, but people will get in crazy comment war arguments about the littlest stuff. And it's just really interesting to see how close to home a lot of this hits for so many people. And you know, the video about dating apps, or the video about like catch up friendships or just things that affect, you know, your average person in their mid-20s. So many people have such an emotional relationship with these concepts that, you know, there are still some people in comment sections of videos I made like a month or two ago that are still going out. I still get notifications. And I'm like, wow, like this really means something to you.
Moving away a bit, not necessarily from social media, because mm-hmm. I know it's like a part of your daily life mm-hmm. now, but just your experience as a 20-year-old, because the idea of this is for it to find some, I don't know, companionship for other people in their 20s living through this decade that I think can be very rewarding but very hard at the same time. What are some things that have kind of really defined these years for you? Like, what have you learned in your 20s? What has been the biggest challenge?
Yeah, so I'm currently 26, and something that's been interesting is, you know, I think that they're like, kind of like, I'm not to like just reference TikTok again, but in the Catch Up Friendships video, I talk about how your compulsion whenever catching up with a friend is to hit on all the categories of life, you know, like work, social, romance, health, family, whatever. And in my 20s so far, I think I've been able to have each of those categories like maximized really, really well, but never at the same time. And I like currently I love my boyfriend. I'm so happy in my relationship, but like work isn't bringing me as much joy. I'm kind of at a career crossroads right now. Yeah. A few years ago, I was obsessed with work. I loved going to work every day, but I was, you know, completely out of luck in dating. And I feel like your 20s are kind of like a testing ground to see like, okay, what environment and what under what circumstances am I happy in this category? And then you kind of have to solve a puzzle of like adding it all together. And I'm obviously like not near having added it all together to have it be the perfect picture of a life. But it's just like getting more data on yourself and what you like. You know, I've been in New York for a little over a year at this point, and it's really interesting to see, okay, how do I feel here versus when I was living in LA? And you know, what's my level of happiness? And can I try to silence a lot of the noise around other things to see if I can just compare them on like a one-to-one basis? Or is it like completely difficult to remove all the other factors in your life? But I guess to more directly answer your question, so far in my 20s, it's, I think, just like been a big process of trying to piece together everything that I have been working on in therapy for the last two freaking decades. And figuring out like who do I want to be every day? And not every day is intentional. I think it's like, it's really hard to live with a constant sense of intentionality because that puts so much pressure on yourself, and it puts so much pressure to feel like every single moment is, you know, super instrumental in building the life that you want. I don't know. I've had days where I just rot in bed, and that, you know, I can't put that on my resume. I can't point to that and say that it benefited me in the long run. But in a sense, it's like you have to kind of relieve some pressure and take some stress off of yourself, because
for sure,
if you want to build the life you want, not every day is going to be the same.
No, for sure. And you mentioned therapy here because you've been in therapy for so long. Do you think you kind of had a sped up process of like getting to know yourself compared to other people? Because I think so many people get to their 20s and they're like, okay, who am I?
I think, well, so I, when I was quite young, I was diagnosed with Tourette's. And my parents were completely beside themselves. They were really, I don't think there was as much like research or understanding about it as there is today. And so that was a big reason why they first sent me to therapy, because they wanted me to get as much help as possible. And I had a pretty mild to moderate case of Tourette's. If anyone doesn't know what Tourette's is, it's basically a combination of motor and vocal tics. And I fortunately, in middle school and the grades during which I had Tourette's, which was like second to sixth grade, people were very nice and no one really made fun of me. And it wasn't a very prominent part of who I was. I had like minor tics, but it wasn't a big deal. But I think the process of going to therapy and having to constantly step outside of myself and assess what was going on with me as a result of having Tourette's made me a lot more like hyper-conscious about social structures and, you know, just how people perceive themselves and how they want. A question I love asking people is, how do you want people to perceive you? Because it's something I've been thinking about for decades, in that like when I was younger, I wanted people to perceive me as like fun and nice and smart. And I think smart was probably the biggest one of those, just that was my family's values. But it's so fascinating to think that like, oh, every single person has a different objective for how they want people to see you. You know, I once asked a friend of mine that, and she was like, oh, I want people to think that I'm a really nice person. And I felt kind of bad because nice was not like the first thing that I want to be perceived as. But obviously I want to be perceived as nice. I don't want people to think I'm horrible. But I recognize that I'm rambling.
No. That makes so much sense. It's like sometimes you hear someone else's answer and you're like, wait, I'm a dickhead because they said nice 100%. And I said smart. It's like, what does that say about me?
Yeah, it's kind of like that old that meme of like Vogue asking Selena Gomez what she can't live without. And she says, my family. Then I ask Kim Kardashian. She goes like, oh, my contour stick. And it's like, well, different strokes, but exactly. No, I think just to sum it up, I think I had good reason to start going to therapy because I had this, you know, condition that my parents were confused by and they wanted me to get treatment for. And what's funny is like I grew out of it after a few years. I grew out of Tourette's. People don't really realize that like it's pretty common to grow out of it if you aren't like, you know, severely afflicted by
it. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's actually really interesting because, you know, still today, every so often, I'll be around someone and they'll make like a somewhat disparaging comment about Tourette's. And I made a promise to my younger self that was like, in those moments, I'm not going to like blow up at the person, but like, I am going to say like, oh, you know, like I used to have Tourette's. This is a misrepresentation of what it's like. And all the time people feel horrible, but they also, I mean, and that's not my intention. I don't want anyone to feel bad because, you know, we've all said the wrong thing and slipped up and everything. But I think my mission in those moments is just to like educate people about what they're misinformed about, because like people genuinely have no idea what the hell.
Yeah. And you live through it. So yeah. It's like, yeah. It's a personal thing.
And it was a huge part of my childhood. It's crazy to think back and think about like, you know, all the presentations I had to give to my classes about what it was and everything. But yeah, I think it just helped me become more self-aware and more introspective and observant of the world around me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so all along, you were more observant of the world around you, but do you think you were also more conscious of who you were?
Yes, for sure. I think that, I mean, that kind of goes hand in hand with the question of like, how do you want people to perceive you? If you're asking that question, it means that you're like prioritizing, like thinking about that to begin with, yeah, which is, you know, not always the best. But yeah, I mean, I think I didn't want there to be anything about me that would immediately turn people away. And I think, you know, when you have a condition that might, you know, make some people judge you, I think that's just like a, you know, a battle that you're always going to be fighting. Again, my experience with Tourette's was like on moderate. Like, I had noticeable tics. I don't want to play that down. I had noticeable tics, but it was only like mildly disruptive. And I think, I'm going to be honest, I was just such an outlandish, eccentric little kid that I think everyone around me kind of just accepted it as part of who I was. So that was a big part of my psyche when I was younger, is like being comfortable being weird, being comfortable being different. And that wasn't always easy. That was pretty hard for a while, because, you know, when you're in middle school, like all you want to do is fit in. Yeah. And I was always grappling with like, okay, I have this thing that like immediately makes me different. Am I going to try to hide it, or am I going to just like embrace it and understand that like differences are what make you beautiful? And that's so cliche. Like, it's so hard to like internalize that when you're 10. But as I've grown older, I've really realized that like our individual differences are what make us connect with each other.
Yeah.
You know?
And in a way, it was like sometimes hardships in that sense. You're like, oh, this is a very specific thing that's making me maybe stand out more in like my weirdness or whatever, that I think is just your individuality, which is a great thing. But it forces you to also get comfortable in your own skin, because it's like, this is out of your control to a point. So you're like, this is who I am, and I'm forced to live with this and like enjoy it, because it's who I am. And I'm glad like you now see it, and you're like, I was already an eccentric kid. Yeah. It was like,
well, and what's funny is it's, I mean, there's a lot of people that are very afraid of being ostracized or you know, set apart in a way that makes them different from the crowd. And when you live like that, I think you experience that firsthand, like there, when you have something that just like visibly makes you different.
Yeah.
And you get to experience the thing that a lot of people fear. And something that has just been so powerful for me, and it was really powerful in my early 20s, is really, really, really giving a thoughtful mind to, okay, what are you so afraid of? And like playing that out, like what are you so afraid of? And if you've ever experienced that thing that you're so afraid of, it like immediately disempowers it, because I think, you know, it's still our like animal conditioning that if we're afraid of something, it's because we think we're going to die if it happens. And that's, you know, physiologically the way that our body reacts, like fight or flight, like, like, you know, the way that, I don't know, a seventh grader at a middle school dance might be terrified that no one wants to dance with them. Like, I'm not going to say that it doesn't suck, because it does suck, but you don't die. Like, you don't, you know, you if you confront the thing that you're so afraid of and recognize that it doesn't have as much power over you as you thought, it really emboldens you to live more freely, I think.
I adore that. And I think I found you through a video that you made on rejection, and like just literally walking up to people and being like asking them out or like introducing yourself and stuff like that. And at first to me that sounded like, oh my god, how did I, like, rejection to me just the most scary thing in the universe. And once I experienced rejection, like first and after, like you going up, building like that courage to do it, and then someone rejects you, and then you realize, wait, it's just a no.
Yeah.
Like, literally, it's just a no. The world didn't end. You're the same person. You can still love yourself. Like, it's not gonna... And if anything, it makes you so much better for it. What were you doing in that moment when you were literally just walking up to people? Where did that come from? And what did you learn from that?
So what you're talking about is spent some time last year just going up and asking guys out on the street. And it was informed by a few things. One, I've always loved talking to strangers. I think that the opportunity to talk to a stranger is so unique, because they have no preconceived notions of you. You are whoever you want to be in their eyes. And I'm not like endorsing the idea of like lying to strangers. I mean, look, if you want to, do it.
Like,
I mean, what's going to happen? But I've always loved talking to strangers. And I've also, and what I've loved about it is that it's an opportunity to meet a new person, and it's so low stakes if you do it safely in like a public environment, whatever. Like if I...
Yeah, don't go up to a stranger's house or like...
Yeah. Like, you know, use common sense. That goes without saying. But I have made friends on the subway by talking to strangers. I made friends in college in the... I have always just loved talking to strangers. And I think that, you know, especially as women, we're very much told, like, you know, you want the men to come up to you. You want to like wait, lie in wait and see, you know, who you can attract and whatever. And
just look at them at most.
Yeah. And it's so funny because like this goes hand in hand with something I learned a couple years ago, which is I learned that guys really don't get a lot of physical compliments. And it started this inside joke with me and my guy friend at work, where I would compliment him on like his sweater or his eyes or his bone structure, and he would tell me how like wise I looked, or you know, a compliment that I wouldn't necessarily get as much. And it made me realize like it's especially considering that like if I were to approach a man on the street, he probably doesn't think I'm about to mug him. He probably doesn't think I'm about to like kill him.
Yeah.
I'm just
versus
like a person.
Exactly.
It's different. If I go to him on the street and I express interest in him, that is such a compliment. That is just such praise. And every single time I went up to guys in the street and asked them out, whether they were in a relationship, whether they're interested or not, every single one of them was so appreciative. They were like, thank you so much. I have so much respect for what you're doing. And It was born from this thing for me where I was like, oh, I'm sick of the dating apps. Like, I want to see if there are any better ways
to meet real world
guys. And I also had this, ever since I was a kid, I really wanted a great meet cute story. And what I realized is, okay, if I want to have an amazing meet cute story, I have to put in the work I'm part of that story. If I want a great meet cute story, I can't just wait for life to happen.
I have to go do the thing.
And even though my current boyfriend I met on Hinge, I was just like, all right, you know, if I want a great meet cute story, if I want the meet cute story to be something like, oh, we met on the street, then I have to actually meet guys on the street. You can't just wait for that fairy tale thing to happen to you. So it was all born from this combination of being tired of the dating apps, wanting an interesting story, and also recognizing that the fears that I had about it, you know,
were just
like, no, like, any sane person who gets asked out on the street and worst case scenario, they're taken or they are not interested, they just tell you that and you move on.
Yeah. Like, and you never have to see them again.
And God forbid, let's say you do have to see them again. Let's say you're in the same coffee shop or they're like a friend of a friend, like whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we often think the worst of ourselves in other people's brains. Like, we assume that other people are going to have the worst possible reaction or worst possible thoughts about us. The thing that I always try to remind myself is like, okay, let's say someone else around me said something pretty embarrassing. How long would I fixate on that?
Yeah,
not long at all. The odds that I would even clock it as being that embarrassing are fairly low.
Yeah.
You know? But to them, you know, who's to say?
You're the center of your own world,
right? Oh, 100%.
So you're like always thinking you're the main person all the time. And it's like, wait, no. It's exactly that. Maybe someone says something embarrassing and you're like, that's embarrassing. 1 second, and then next thought, you're thinking about your own life or your own things or whatever.
And like new things always have, like there's, life is just a constant influx of novel things. Yeah. So they're...
You'll fixate on the next thing.
Exactly.
And then the next thing.
Yeah.
So what did you learn like walking up to people? Was there something that was, you were like, okay, this is creepy, don't do this again, this works?
Something I learned was probably not ideal to ask someone out if they have AirPods in. Because
you're gonna scare them.
You might scare them, and then you also have to get them to take out their AirPods. And I think that like the transition of going from having been listening to like music or a podcast or something to talking to someone is a little jarring. It's a little abrupt. So I had to learn that firsthand in terms of like, all right, if someone has AirPods in, also this they could be on a phone call. You know, they could be fully talking to someone else. I love John Mulaney. I once saw him on a New York street in 2018, and I was like, oh my god, my chance to speak to John Mulaney. And I went up to him and I was like, I just have to say, and he turns to me and he goes, I'm on the phone, but thank you. And I mean, he had had earbuds. I was just like muscling through. I was like, I'm going to talk to him, whatever. And what I always remember about that is like, I never actually complimented him. So I don't know why he said thank you. Like I could have been telling him like, John Mulaney, your hair's on fire. Like, I don't know what he thought. But the point being that that experience alone should have educated me on like, all right, don't go up to someone if they have AirPods in or just headphones in whatsoever.
That scarred you. It was like you really wanted to talk to him.
Yeah. But and also, I think a memorable one is I once asked out a guy as he was entering a flower shop. Oh. And yeah, so dumb of me. I think that was the first guy I asked out on the street. And then from that, I had to learn location. Yeah. If this guy is, well, first
buying
of all,
flowers, they won't be for himself. Yeah,
well, first of all, even on a broader scale, okay, I live a few blocks from I think it's a funeral home. I've never paid that much mind to it. It's like a mortician. It's something to do with death, embalming, yeah, whatever. If someone were to be entering or exiting that, probably not the best move for you to ask them out. So, okay, in terms of like, you should be asking someone out in like a innocuous.
Yeah. I mean, flower shop is the worst because either someone died or they have a significant other.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like, what are the odds that this guy is going to be walking and be like, I just want to buy some hydrangeas for myself. It's fine Sunday. Like, probably not. And more power to you if you're the kind of person that just like buys flowers for yourself regularly. Couldn't be me. Could not be me. I can't take care of a thing at all, like even for a few days. I killed 11 fish when I was a kid. Not like in that I killed them in cold blood, but I could
like
not
take.
I know, yeah. Like I would say to people, in the summer of 2004, I killed all 11 fish that I owned. No, I just could not take care of them. I did not have a good feeding schedule. I couldn't, so I can't do that with plants. So like maybe a green flag if a guy is into plants, as my current boyfriend is.
Yeah, but don't ask them out there.
Yeah, but don't ask them out. Don't ask them out there. Yeah. So if there's, you know, walking.
So it's location.
Location.
No AirPods.
No AirPods. Yeah.
Any other tip for anyone who might want to, guys, build up the courage. Do it.
I mean, I never went up and asked someone out when they were in a group or with one other person. I always asked people out when they were alone. I don't think it's the worst case scenario if they're with another person, but I mean, okay, well, hold on.
It does make it harder.
It makes it hard because it's so fun. This is the dumbest reference, but I remember in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire when did you ever read Harry Potter?
Oh my God, I read them. I watched every movie.
I just distinctly remember Ron complaining to Harry about
the French ladies that they're all together.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow. Oh, I'm so glad we were aligned on that. And I just, I was like, I must have been like 7 or 8 years old. And I remember reading that and be like, oh, poor Ron. Like all these girls are clustering together. It's so hard for him to ask them out.
Yeah.
And I remember that as an adult. I was like, okay, am I gonna want to go up to a group of 6 guys and ask one of them out? I mean, that would be baller.
Yeah.
That would be so cool of me. Am I that cool? I don't know.
That would take like an humongous amount of confidence.
Oh my God. I know, like, especially, and what's so funny about that is it's like, okay, what's making me pick this one guy out of the six? Like, if I were those guys, I would be wondering, like,
why did she pick him and not me?
Like, yeah, but I mean, depending on the guy, I'm sure some would be like overjoyed to be asked. Some would be like, oh my God, this is like my personal idea of hell being asked out in front of
my friends.
So I digress. I think it's probably advantageous to ask someone out when they're alone, just because if they're with a friend, if they're with someone that they know, they're immediately going to look to that person. They're immediately going to look to them to be like, oh my God, like, is this happening right now? Like, wait, this is so funny. Like, this is a story we're going to tell later. And I don't think they're as present in the moment about like engaging with you if they have someone that they have in the back of their mind, like, oh, this person is watching me as I react right now too. So probably best advice is to ask someone out if they're alone, just because I feel like also if someone's alone, they're going to be more receptive to strangers. I love making friends on airplanes. I love meeting strangers on airplanes. It's crazy. I have a hack where
you have them trapped in the airplane. So
Well, you have to be judicious about it. But I went to Brown and I grew up in Chicago, and so I flew the Southwest Chicago to Providence flight, Providence to Chicago, many, many times a year. And so I got really good at flying Southwest. And for anyone who doesn't know about Southwest, their boarding system is different than other airlines, that you're not assigned a seat, you're assigned an order in which you get to choose your seat. So people just filter onto the plane and they just pick the seat that they want. And if you're first on the plane, you have your pick of the litter. There's no first class. It's more of a budget airline. So it's just you get to pick how far you want to sit. And my strategy was always, I was always towards the front of the pack. I would get on the plane and there would be maybe in like the fourth row, someone sitting in the window. I would sit in the aisle. And then how I would always make friends with the person in the window by doing the exact same thing every single time, like clockwork. I would turn to them and I would say, let's look really mean so that nobody chooses to sit in the middle of us. Every single time, that person would crack up. They would be like, oh my God, that's so funny.
Yeah.
And obviously, we're not going to sit there looking really, really mean because that's like a whole other thing. But just even broaching the idea with someone, they would always laugh about that. Yeah. And had I, and so if they're sitting in the window and there's no one next to them, they're traveling alone. And so I think in moments of solitude, people are more open to connecting with a stranger than if they're with their friends.
But you know what? That's brilliant as well, because I think what works really well when meeting someone new is like find something that will make you like fight towards the same thing in common, right?
Yeah.
So even if, even as a joke, but you're like, okay, now we want this seat to be empty and we're both like,
100%.
We're basically being like,
establishing
like allies in this thing. I think.
No, that's exactly establishing similar goals. It's actually something I keep in mind when I love hosting, I love throwing parties, I love bringing my friends together. And something I've learned is that an ideal party is not necessarily just assembling a bunch of people in a room and expecting them to all just become friends, you know, because sometimes there's a higher lift. Something that I have always done when I've hosted anything is try to create an agenda for people where like there's a game involved or there's some sort of goal where you're in alignment. Like one of my favorite parties I've ever thrown was a murder mystery party that I wrote. I created so many random side C plots that had nothing to do with the murder, like just to get people to find ways to connect with each other. This is so random, but it was a celebrity murder mystery party. So every person was in character as a celebrity. And I had made two of my friends be Elon Musk and Grimes. And I had written like in their individual notes, like to have an argument about the pronunciation of their child's name. And
eggs, whatever.
Yeah, 100%.
It's like a letter.
So. Yeah. And just watching my friends just get into a spat about the pronunciation of their fake child's name, I saw it like made them more, 100%. Because if you're in, if you both buy into something, if you buy into being characters in a murder mystery party, being aligned and wanting to look mean on a Southwest flight, if you both buy in, then there's a sense of camaraderie there.
This is what I found so special about you, that I'm like, this is the things where you like hit it right in the nail.
I should make a video about that. I haven't.
No, for sure you should, because it's true that like even in socializing, some people think like some people are just good and some people are not that like open and whatever, but there's truly, even if you struggle socializing, there are some like even strategies where you can make like random encounters more like friendly and just easier for you, and that they will probably have better outcomes. And like you're noticing these tiny details, that it's true, it's like you sit on the airplane and say this little comment and that works better than just like, I don't know, saying a comment that might throw them off. So it's like, I think just your perspective on things is so interesting. You just mentioned that you wrote this for the party, like the celebrity murder mystery. You studied English.
Yeah.
How was that, like, in terms of your career path and like college life versus post-college life? Why did you study English, and how were your college years and then transitioning to going out of college? Because at least for me, and I think in the 20s, that's like such a monumental stage, like early 20s, late teens for early 20s, you're living college, then you get out, it's a whole new life. Some people love college, some people struggle through it. How was that for you?
Yeah, so ever since I was a kid, I loved writing and I loved stories. So it always just felt very natural for me to gravitate towards English, both in middle school, high school, college, you know, everything. And I went into college pretty sure I was going to, at Brown they call it concentrate, not major. It's, you know, just, but it's semantics, it's major, whatever, study English. And at Brown, they have this thing called the open curriculum where you don't have any requirements for classes that you have to take. There's no like gen eds or anything. You just take whatever you want to take.
That's amazing.
Oh, it was great. I mean, in hindsight, I wish I'd had a little bit more structure because I think I would have taken a wider variety of classes. I didn't take any STEM classes. And
wow.
Yeah. And, wow. And I know.
That's a dream for some people.
Well, it was the dream for me at the time. But now in hindsight, I'm like, okay, I probably could have, you know, broadened my horizons a little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I took English classes and then I took a bunch of different classes in like history and psychology and cognitive science and everything. But I always, like, I just had this dream ever since I was a child of working in Hollywood. So during the summers, I would do internships at various Hollywood companies. I worked at production companies, studios, networks, talent agencies,
whatever. Was this always in LA?
So my first and third summer were in LA. My second summer was in New York. I wanted to get a whole sense of
the industry.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And when I graduated in May of 2020, so like right into the thick of the pandemic. And I had been struggling in college for a while because I had a really negative high school experience, and it stayed with me in college in a lot of ways that I didn't really understand until later in college when I got diagnosed with PTSD. I had been bullied very badly in high school, and I think that I had assumed that it would all leave me once I left high school. But when you're 14, 15, 16, you know, being fed a narrative that you're like disgusting and ugly and horrible and all these different things, you don't realize how much you internalize it. And I lived a lot of my college existence truly believing a lot of these things about myself and living in fear that other people would discover them about me if I didn't like protect myself in some way. So I ended up right after I graduated going to like a psychiatric treatment program to really unpack a lot of the shit that I'd been through. Sorry, I have not sworn up until this point.
Go ahead.
I don't know why I assumed I couldn't swear.
And that's so fucked up. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because like a lot of it was just very normal to me. But like I don't know. Just as an anecdote, I remember when I was in high school, all this shit would happen to me that I didn't really realize was abnormal. Like, for example, I remember once when I was a freshman, a boy and I were texting about an upcoming party that was going to happen. And we were like, ooh, like maybe we'll make out or something like that. I don't know. Next day, I get another text from him. I'm in math class. He goes, just because you hear about a party doesn't mean you're invited. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, we were just talking about this yesterday. And then he starts sending me like horrible, nasty, mean texts about me and about like, why do I think I'm hot shit? Like all this different, I didn't think I was hot shit. I was like 14. And it was just like the meanest stuff I'd ever heard. And I was so confused. And then I walk out of my math class and I see he's standing in his locker surrounded by like six guys. So they were all like conspiring for what to text me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. Like, and that stuff happened to me all the time in high school. It was just like, unfortunately, part of my experience. And it wasn't until like my senior year of college, I got diagnosed with PTSD. I learned like, oh, all this stuff that's happened to me is like pretty fucked up. And
so fucked up.
I had no idea how much it stayed with me and how much it informed my self-worth and my perception of myself. And so that's what compelled me to take the opportunity during the pandemic to like really work on myself, like do more intensive therapy. Because like I said, I've been doing therapy for 20 years, but you don't always realize in therapy, like you might be lying to yourself. And I don't mean lying to yourself in a way where you're actively deluding yourself and you're actively trying to like paint a picture that isn't true. But there were stories I never told in therapy because I genuinely thought they happened to everyone and I genuinely thought they were normal. And I mean, on a certain level, I'm sure I was like deeply ashamed and I didn't want to bring up old wounds. But then when I got to this treatment program and I was with other people who had all been through their own version of hell, I remember I would like tell stories and people would be like, I guess. People would be like, what the hell? Like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
And it made me realize that I just had spent so much of my life in ignorance of the things that had happened to me. And I'm very, very grateful for the time I spent in that treatment program because it really enabled me to kind of deconstruct who I was as a person, figure out what had informed my self-perception, and rebuild a much, much stronger sense of self.
And I think it's interesting that you use work on yourself, mm-hmm. but it's also working on things that happen to you that have nothing to do with who you are. And I think it's making that distinction of being like, these people were so shitty to me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't inform my persona and who I am. It's just like, it's something that happened to me. It's not who I am. And whatever they did to me or made me think I was, like, truly has nothing to do with who I am. And I think that process of like, I think especially when you've been through traumatic stuff mm-hmm. like that, that they are in the end tearing who you are apart. Like, they make you feel like absolute shit.
Yeah.
And the second that you believe them, it's like you're losing. So you cannot believe them. And that's when the work comes in, to be like working on myself to know that this is not true.
Yeah. And it's really painful because I think you don't want to actively think about those memories or those things. Like, oh, that's why a lot of people develop coping mechanisms that help them take their mind off of
it. And what you said of like lying in therapy, it's not that you're lying. It's just like, I think it's a defense mechanism.
You're protecting. Yeah, you're protecting yourself. Like for me, right around the time I started getting bullied, like a little bit after, I developed a really bad eating disorder. It was binge eating disorder. So I would just cope with food. Anytime I was stressed out or feeling unworthy or insecure, I would just turn to food. And that just created, and that was another huge thing that I worked on in my treatment program, was trying to, you know, redefine my relationship with food and not have it be this like ostensible panacea for all my problems. Because it's not, you know, no coping mechanism ever is. It's like, I once heard this really this metaphor that I really resonate with, which is that like, if you have like a nail stuck in your foot and you drink morphine every day to deal with the pain, the solution is not to keep drinking morphine. The solution is to take a look at the nail on your foot and try to pull it out or try to deal with it. But it is so painful. It is so painful to like take a full look at what's causing you harm.
Yeah. But you can only take morphine that long.
Yeah.
Like you can't
die.
Live.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Or your foot gets infected or like whatever. It's like you eventually those problems. And I think it's interesting for you that you were like, you weren't still in high school or right out of high school. It took like four years.
Oh my God. One of the biggest regrets in my life is that I didn't do that work on myself before college. I think it would have really changed.
But it also like, I think it's what you said. It's like such a traumatic experience that it wasn't like, it comes to a point where it's not even a choice to deal with it. It's just, it's presenting itself and it's like just manifesting itself in your social life and in who you are, and it's not allowing you to live. So it's like you're forced to face it. But of course, it's not nice. And I think you weren't ready before.
And it took me so long to even feel comfortable talking about it out loud, because I think I was always like, when you have that like devil on your back of like these people that have hurt you, like the people in high school that were really mean to me, I constantly lived in fear that like anything I said would get back to them, even years later, which is hilarious. You know, I would never have thought that I could go on a podcast and even share a smidgen of my experience, because I was always so afraid of like being
back to them.
Yeah. And it's like, honestly, I'm 26. Like, I haven't been in those environments for nearly a decade, and I'm allowed to like speak the truth of my, I'm allowed to fully recognize all of my life experiences.
And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people grow through stuff like that. And I'm sure like a person that listens to this and has been through the same, that has either done the work with it or hasn't done the work with it, is like a story that might be benefiting other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that's literally the whole point of this and why I chose to do it, because I think that's the great power in stories. It's just like feeling that you're understood and that you're not the only one going through shitty stuff, and that people have come out the other end and like, look at you now, you know?
And I have this metric that I always use where like, anytime anything bad happens to me, I ask myself, is this going to matter in 6 months? And usually the answer is no. And that always makes me feel better. Now, when senior year I got diagnosed with PTSD, the answer was not no. I was like, fuck, like this could still matter. And I had to reconcile with that, like, okay, how am I going to move forward in my life knowing that this is a really big deal to me right now, and like will probably continue to be a big deal in some capacity. And the way that I thought about it was like, all right, I can have my whatever five stages of grief, whatever you want to call it, I can go through the motions, go through the process of like absorbing this recognition about what's happened to me, but at the very end I can find purpose in it. And that was something that really carried me through a lot of the pain, was like, okay, I might not have purpose right in this very second, but I will be able to find purpose and meaning from these things that have happened to me, because like you know, the people who have been through horrible, awful stuff, they can either choose to be defined by it or they can choose to speak out about it and you know, become an advocate for other people to hope that they don't go through the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, am I a motivational speaker on bullying? No, I don't really think that that would be in my wheelhouse. But I do think that being able to talk to other people about stuff that I went through has really shown me, oh my God, so many people go through. Like, this is what I was saying earlier, in that, like, there are so many universal experiences. Even though someone might not be able to relate exactly to a specific example of something that I went through, they can probably relate to having gone through something. Yes. Having gone through something that made them feel ostracized, isolated, alone.
Yeah.
And even if that was, like, I don't know, being a child of divorce and always being shuttled. But I'm not a child of divorce. Yeah. So I don't know. But I'm just trying to give an example of, like,
yes,
something else that would make. And so people can relate to the feeling you're talking about. And in that, you're never truly alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. So having lived through all of this, is there something that you would tell your younger self that was struggling and that was just, yeah,
this is going to sound bad? This is going to sound crazy. And I still question 100% of whether it's true. But after I started in my therapy program and I told a lot of the stories about what had happened to me, especially in high school, and, like, I am glossing over, like, 99% of the stuff. Like, there is so... But, like, you don't need to sit here and have me tell you stories about all that. I was talking to one of my therapists about it, and he just looked at me in the eye. He's like, Bianca, why do you think they were jealous of you? And I laughed at him. I was like, these people, they were not jealous of me. Like, I was their punching bag. He's like, no, why do you think they were jealous of you? And first and foremost, I don't think that it's a healthy response to assume that anything that happens to you, someone's jealous of you. That's a very narcissistic perspective. But what I understood that he was getting at was, when I entered high school, I was a very rambunctious, flamboyant, eccentric, you know, like I said, I was like that as a kid, and that's how I grew up, and that was part of my personality. And through targeting and being really cruel to me, these kids were saying something, which is probably there was something valuable in the experience of being, you know, weird and quirky and offbeat and unusual. And that's something that I think a lot of people wish they could exhibit themselves, but don't always have the confidence or the self-assuredness to.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, if I could tell my younger self anything, it would just be, like, there is immense value in being yourself.
Yeah.
There's immense value in being true to yourself, being, like, you know, not trying to conform. And again, that is so hard when you're 14, 15, 16. Like, that conformity is what everyone wants. But I think I you know, like I said, I grew up with Tourette's. Like, I was forced to be nonconformist from the very beginning because I had this thing that, you know, separated me right away. And I think I would just tell my younger self, like, don't lose sight of the things that make you special and different.
Yeah. That's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And it's shameful on them that was what they would attack you on. But I do agree in the, like, I think jealous is, like, such a strong word, but it's like, in the end, you had something that they wanted. I think that's the point that he was trying to make, where it was like, you were just so yourself that it bothered them because they couldn't do it. They didn't have the balls or ovaries to be like, this is who I am.
And
and it's true. In high school, all you want to do is, like, fit in and be like everyone else. And the more you grow, you realize, actually, there's so much more value in just being whoever the fuck you want to be and who you truly are than trying to be someone else, because that will last you 5 minutes and then you won't be able to do it anymore.
Yeah. And also, I mean, this is different, but something I've learned later in life is that it is so embarrassing to have been popular in high school, I think. Maybe that's a hot take. But I
love it. Like, please explain. Why do you think that is?
Because I
low-key agree a bit.
I think, you know, for so many people, high school is this really confusing, difficult, you know, complicated time. And people are navigating, like, coming of age. They're navigating relationships. I was not navigating relationships in high school. No one wanted to date me. But it's just a very loaded time. And I think that the structures that dictate popularity in high school are so out of whack with how I think people like relate to people later in life and how people connect with people and how people value each other. In high school, if you're like hot at a young age, that's what determines popularity. If you have access to money, if you have access to alcohol, that kind of thing dictates your popularity at a young age. And like, because when you're, what, 14 to 18, you're still dependent on your parents in so many ways. So your life is like largely controlled by forces outside of you. Later in life, you can, you have a lot more agency. You have a lot more freedom, I think, to live the life that you want. And if you were popular in high school, that does not say anything about your character. That does not say anything about your value. That just says you were dealt a hand that was lucky early on. And I have just related to so many people later in life where we're like, oh my, we were so uncool in high school. Like, they'll have their own stories about being made fun of. They'll have their own stories about like having no one to go to prom with having a unibrow. I don't know. Like, everyone have, it's just such an awkward time. And if someone like can't relate to that and is like, oh yeah, no, I was really cool and everyone wanted to be my friend.
Lack of character.
That's like, first of all, yeah, you don't have character building experiences if things were easy for you, you know?
You know what? You're bringing up something that reminds me of some conversations that I have with friends. Sometimes I think that's why like the best looking guys can be so vanilla.
Oh my God,
because it's
yeah.
like they haven't had instances in which they had to build character and become like really funny or become ultra confidence. It's just like their main guard is their looks.
When I was younger, and this is a little bit more in middle school, I like separated boys out in two categories in my mind. There were the computer geek boys and the basketball shorts boys. And the computer geek boys were the ones who always had a crush on me. And I was like, I don't want anything to do with you, because I was like a dumb little middle schooler. And the basketball shorts boys were named like Josh and Max. And they were like cool and everything. And they never liked me. They never had any interest in me. And later in life, you get to see how the basketball shorts boys and the computer geek boys grow up.
Yeah.
And also, I'm sure that anyone who had their own naming system for girls, I was whatever the opposite of a basketball shorts girl is. Like, I'm not saying that I was hot. I absolutely was not. But it's so interesting to see later in life how these people grow up and like, oh, these things that made you different or these things that like created hardships for you growing up, like they're character building and they become part of your identity, personality. And you can, again, if you can find purpose in them, if you can find meaning in them, then you can like synthesize them into like being the coolest person that you are now.
Yeah.
Versus like, if everyone loved you, if everything was easy for you, then you probably have never really been through that much that like helps you understand how to relate to other people. Because that's the last thing I'll say about like why it's embarrassing to be popular or to have been popular in high school, is that if you don't know what it's like to have been insecure, ostracized, made fun, all these different things, you probably can't relate to most people, you know?
Because like, that's true.
Popularity is,
it's like it's the top 1% of the high school hierarchy.
It's an unusual experience.
Yeah.
So like you probably are not as adept at connecting with people if you don't know what it's like to be shunned.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I think that's even in your TikToks, it's the great power of relatability.
Mm-hmm.
It's the and we've mentioned so many ways it all ties to the same thing. It's like your experiences are mostly universal. Mm-hmm. And I think the feeling of like either being insecure or not being the top of the chain in high school, like all these things, they're mostly a universal experience. Like a lot of people go through this.
Yeah. And I mean, something that I think about a lot is like when trying to, or when thinking about how to perceive a world that isn't, Like we all go through our daily life with our blinders on and trying to connect more with people. The way that I think about things sometimes is like, okay, I'm right-handed. Who has a better sense of what in the world is made for right-handed people, me or a left-handed person? Undeniably a left-handed person, because they're confronted with that hardship of being left-handed every single day.
Yeah.
And they're so hyper aware of everything in the world that was designed specifically not for them.
Yeah.
I have idea. Everything in the world was designed for me. So I don't know, like this is a round table. I could argue that it was designed for me just as much as a pencil was, because I don't know, it all works for me, you know? When everything works for you, you're not going to pay attention to how it was constructed to work or not.
That's
to work.
So true.
Yeah. So I just think about that all the time in terms of, like, there are people in the world, like, when you experience things that are not designed for you, when you experience situations or settings that work against you, you are going to emerge so much more observant and so much more aware of how things in the world are designed, how situations are set up, versus someone who just gets to kind of coast through everything because they have no idea.
I'm really sorry you had to go through some shitty things, but I think your journey of really coming onto yourself and, like, who you are now and who you, like, how you view the world is so powerful and so great. And that's why I, like, literally love everything that you put out. I'm like, Bianca is so great, and I'm so glad we met in person. I know we're a bit tight on time, but I always ask for a little recommendation that you might have for other people on something to consume, whether it's like a book, a TV show, a movie. What's a little piece of content that you think might be good to 20-year-olds out there?
Okay. Do we want to go, like, can I do one funny and one serious?
For sure. Okay. And it can be, like, because it doesn't have to be serious. It can be, like, just something that makes you feel good. So the funny.
Okay. So one of my favorite TV shows of all time is called Nathan For You. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Okay. This guy, Nathan Fielder, it's kind of like a half scripted, half reality show. He portrays a consultant and he goes and helps small businesses improve their, you know, profits. But his ideas are crazy. Okay. They're like so out of left field. Like, one of my favorite episodes is he helps out, this is a bit of a spoiler, but he wants to go help out a haunted house that's been struggling. And so his idea is, instead of the typical haunted house experience where you go in and things pop out at you and jump scares and there's gross stuff and then you leave, whatever, you go, in his design, you go in and you have the things that pop out of you, whatever. You have, like, one of the cast member women, like, jump out. And then halfway through, they shut down the haunted house. And they're like, oh, my God, like, we're so sorry. And the proprietor of the haunted house comes out. He's like, I'm so sorry. I think one of my employees accidentally touched you. And then the employee comes out. She's like, I'm so sorry. I have this rare disease. Like, I thought that I had my glasses on. I didn't really, my depth perception wasn't good. I'm so sorry. I think I might have infected you. And then you're like, and they're like, oh, we need to call an ambulance. And they get in hazmat suits and they take you to the hospital. And it's this whole thing. And they're like, okay, we need to go to the South Bay. There's, like, sirens on. It's like this horrible thing. And then they open the door out of the ambulance and you let out. And it goes, like, end of haunted house.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's just a small example of, like,
wow,
like,
genius.
Right? And it's so, and, like, I mean, I think that goes hand in hand with, like interesting perspectives on the world. Like, I think his work is
so funny. I feel like
so
you could have come up with that.
Oh, it would be my dream to have any affiliation with Nathan Fielder. But I think everything he does is genius. But and what's so interesting is the show was made in the mid 2010s when, like, the concept of going on, or, like, being on TV and becoming famous on TV was, like, really taking off. So it's so fascinating to see real people, how they react in real settings when the cameras are on them, and you see what they're willing to do because there are cameras on them. It is so fascinating.
Amazing. Love that.
Yeah.
And what's the serious one?
Serious one is, there is a piece of writing that I love. There's this author named Tim Kreider, Kreider. He is genius. Everything he writes, Quentin Tarantino once said something about, like, the greatest art is like stealing, or
stealing ideas.
If I could steal everything Tim Kreider has ever said, I would. I think he is a genius. He wrote this beautiful, beautiful essay in a book collection. I have a bunch of different essays swirling around my head right now, but my favorite is this one he wrote for the New York Times, like, magazine section. If you Google it, it's only available if you like Google it, like, Tim Kreider, like, I know what you think of me. I think I'm butchering the title. It's something about, like, I know what you think of me. And he analyzes the experience of having sent a mass email to a bunch of people in a joking manner and getting an accidental reply from someone that was, like, making fun of him, and unpacking the, like, mortifying nature of being perceived, and knowing that there's a line in there about if we know that someone, like, mocks us or makes fun of us or whatever, we assume they hate us. We assume that that's, like, the prevailing notion in their mind, where, like, you know, you haven't and you're wonderful, but you might have said something that like annoyed me a little bit earlier. You didn't, I promise. But like, let's say you did. If you knew that I thought that, you would probably be like, God damn it, Bianca hates me.
Yeah.
Whereas like, if I had said something that annoyed you, you might be like, oh, that kind of annoying, but like, I'm moving on.
Yeah,
like,
there's
so much else to Bianca. There's so much in it. And we, so what the thesis of that is, we don't really allow in other people interiority in the same way we allow it in ourselves, which is like, yeah, I can love my friend and be a little bit annoyed with her at the same time and still love,
you know,
yeah. So it's just a phenomenal essay. Like, Tim Kreider, I Know What You Think of Me.
Amazing.
It's so good.
Bianca, loved everything about this. Thank you so much for coming on. I truly appreciate you and loved everything you said. I think this can be very useful for a lot of people.
It's amazing.
And to anyone listening, thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.